The following audio is brought to you by Summerside Community Church in London, Ontario. For more information on Summerside, visit us online at www.summersidechurch.ca.
Well, imagine your friend, your good friend, comes to you and says, "Have you heard about the newest restaurant that just opened in town? It is legitimate Indian food. It's called the Hindu Feast, and it's getting rave reviews from everyone. And hey, do you want to come down? Let's go check it out next Friday." So you said, "Sure." So you get some friends together, and Friday you head down to the Hindu Feast, and you walk in the front door, and the incense hits you. Now, I know some of you would walk out right then because you can't handle the smell, but you're thinking, "Whoa, this is a real cultural experience." And you walk in and you sit down and you look at the menu and it's like, "Whoa, this is really unique." And you find out that everything's got these strange names. And you've heard, because you read some of the reviews, that some of the best dishes are their Brahma burger, which you know really isn't a burger because most Indians don't eat meat if they're Hindus, right? So it's a vegetarian, but it tastes like beef, okay? So you know that is really good. And the other one they have is the Vishnu vermicelli. And you notice that every dish on the menu starts with a name. And your friend explains to you that each dish is named after a Hindu god. And there are millions of them, so they're never going to run out of names to name dishes. And you thought, "Oh, okay." So you think, you're thinking, maybe I'm going to have the Vishnu burger. Maybe that vermicelli sounds good. And you sort of notice, you look around and you notice that as the servers are coming out of the kitchen, they stop at one of the either pictures or carvings that are all over the place. And they sort of bow down and present their dish. And then they take it to the table. And you're like, "That's sort of goofy, that's sort of weird." And your friend says, well, yeah, this is a Hindu, the people that own it are Hindu. And so they believe that before they give you the food, they want to offer it to the gods so that, it's blessed, So you're getting this food that's blessed by this god. And you sort of think, "Well, that's sort of strange." And it starts a discussion around your table. It's like, "Okay, is this a problem for Christians to eat this food that is offered to these Hindu gods?" And somebody says, "Well, it's meat." Well, not meat, but it's some kind of food. It's not like the God is real. So it's not like this food that God has created, that the true and living God has created, somehow transforms because it's offered in a sacrifice. So it's not like it's contaminated. And someone else says, "Yeah, and the gods aren't real anyway. So even offering to them, they're not real gods. So what's the point? How can that be a problem?" And then you remember that in your group is Sam. Now, Sam got saved out of Hinduism, and he grew up in India. And so you're sort of curious, "Well, Sam, you came out of this background. What do you think?" Sam says, "Well, I don't know, man. I sort of feel weird being here because it's just weird that they offer this, and it brings back some bad memories of the past." But somebody says, "But Sam, these gods aren't real, right?" "Well, yeah, and that's just not true, right? So just deal with it, At that point, the server shows up and says, "Well, you guys ready to order? What would you do? Would you place your order? Or would you get up and walk out?" See, what we're caught with here is this tension between what is true and the knowledge of what I know, that these gods aren't real. That they are just gods, that man-made idols. And at the same time, I'm caught up with the problem with my friend Sam, who is feeling uncomfortable about this, and he's come out of this background. So how do I respond to this? So we live in this tension of the knowledge that says it's no big deal and love, which says for some people it is a big deal. So how do we respond? how do we make decisions about right and wrong when we have this tension between what we know and people we love and the struggle that they're having? How do we respond to this dilemma? That's what we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. I would invite you to turn there. It's on page 1148 if you're using a Bible in the chair in front of you. And we find here that Paul is answering questions that the church has been asking him. It started in chapter 7. At this point, there's a division in the book in chapter 7 where Paul is responding to things that they wrote him about, questions that they wrote him about. And he's already been dealing about with the question of marriage and singleness in chapter 7. And in chapter 8, it starts out by saying now about food sacrificed to idols. Because they had asked him the question, what about food that has been sacrificed to idols? And Paul is going to spend 3 chapters addressing this issue. And we already looked at chapter 9, which we saw last week, where Paul is defending his rights, because the rights are a part of this. And then he comes back to the subject again in chapter 10. And we're going to deal with that in a few weeks. So this is sort of like the introduction to this subject. But before we get into the text, I need to give you a little bit of background to help you to understand a little bit about what they're struggling with. Back in those days in Corinth, we know there were a number of temples there. And at these temples, the people would bring their animal sacrifices, just like the Jews had animal sacrifices. Other religions also had animal sacrifices. So they would bring their animal sacrifice, present it to the priest at the temple. The priest would slaughter the animal, and some of it would be placed on the altar and offered as a sacrifice. Now, they didn't do this with all of the meat because it would just be too much. So part of the meat would be offered as a sacrifice, and then there'd be a lot of leftovers. So the leftovers wouldn't just go to waste. What they would do is that the priest would keep some of it for his own family and his own use. And that was similar in Judaism, in the Old Testament, that the priests were allowed to do that. But in Corinth, the priests, what they would also do is some of the meat would be used by the people that actually brought the meat could take some of it and have a worshipful meal, a sacrificial meal at the temple, as part of the temple, and they had arrangements where the people could eat the meal in the presence of the gods so that they could make that part of their worship. There were also banquet halls, and archaeologists have actually found that in Corinth there's evidence that there was this big hall right beside the temple, beside one of the temples, indicating that it would be a place where they would have banquets. And so they would have a lot of good meat, and so they would, you know, have a butcher, and they would have people serving. They would provide these big banquets. That was the place for gathering. But there was still meat left over, and so some of the meat would end up going down to the marketplace. And down at the market, you would show up, and if you showed up, you know, if they had a big festival on the weekend, you could show up on Monday morning and find out that T-bone steaks are on special this week because there were a lot of, you know, there was a lot of beef that was slaughtered. And that was some of the best meat you could buy, but it was a little cheaper too, right? Because it was used, you know, it had already been offered, and now it was, you know, now it's being sold. So you could buy this, and Christians would sit there and say, you know, how do we deal with this? I mean, we got saved out of that. I came out of that background where I used to worship idols and I used to do all that stuff. Now I don't know whether God is honored, because I know that idols are wrong. I shouldn't commit idolatry. That's a clear commandment. But how do I deal with this unholy hamburger? How are we supposed to respond to this? So you're a Christian living there, and maybe you get your friend who is in the pottery guild says, hey, you know, you like coming to help us with the pottery sometime, and they've got a big banquet for everybody in the pottery guild down at the temple this weekend. Come on down, it's going to be a great time. Should a Christian go and eat at a banquet at the temple? Should they buy the meat that's sold in the market that was offered in the sacrifice? So how do you respond to things like this? What's a Christian supposed to do? Some Christians are thinking, well, you should just follow your heart, and if you don't feel good about it, don't do it. Other Christians are saying, These gods aren't real. This isn't true. It doesn't matter. Follow your head. Go with knowledge instead of your conscience and what you feel, and go with love. So this is the tension that Paul is dealing with. What determines right and wrong in some situations? Is it knowledge of the facts, or is it love for my brother or sister in Christ? Let's see what Paul says in chapter 8, beginning of verses 1 through 3. Paul says, "Now about food sacrificed to idols, we know that we all possess knowledge." And the words know or knowledge are going to show up a lot in this chapter. And if you can circle them, you'll find them show up a number of times. We all possess knowledge. And it's in quotes because there seems to be a good indication, like we've seen in Corinth, that Paul quotes some of their own sayings, maybe even some of the things they said in their letter. He says, we know we all possess knowledge. But knowledge puffs up while love builds up. Those who think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know, but whoever loves God is known by God. So here's the issue that Paul is making. He's saying that knowledge alone does not determine right and wrong. And notice what he says about knowledge. The problem with knowledge is that knowledge puffs up. You notice how the more you know, the more you're quite pleased with what you know? And today, it's like, some people like to be able to know a lot of stuff about everything. And there's a sense of pride. I like it when people come to me to ask their questions because I know, right? I can give them answers. And so you get known as a person that knows a lot. And knowledge has this tendency to puff up. But Paul says, in contrast to love, love doesn't bring about pride in yourself. Love brings about something good in someone else. So love builds up. Knowledge has a tendency to puff up. And we all have seen people with a lot of knowledge that do some really dumb things, right? I'm sure you can give some illustrations. And in verse 3, when it comes to our relationship with God, knowledge and love go together. And it's interesting that he doesn't say, whoever loves God knows God. He says, whoever loves God is known by God. Because for God to know us is for God to love us and have that experience and relationship with him. So knowledge of the facts isn't enough to determine if something is good or bad or right or wrong. Love should influence the choice that you make when it comes to deciding between right and wrong. Let's continue in verse 4. So then, about eating food sacrificed to idols. Here he is. He said, I'm just getting back to the topic again. About food sacrificed to idols. We know that an idol is nothing in the world. There's the quotes again in the NIV indicating that Paul is quoting one of their statements. And that, another quote, there is no God but one. So an idol is nothing. There's no God but one. Verse 5, for even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, right? There are a lot of people that worship gods and a lot of different, the Hindus have their millions of them. Yet for us, there is but one God, the Father from whom all things came and from whom we live. And there is but one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live. Now, what he's saying is that knowledge is still important. He's saying that knowledge isn't good enough to make the decision, but it is still important. He says there are some things we know that are important in making decisions when it comes to these things. And there are many little gods, little g gods, but we know that there is only one true God. And verse 6 is a powerful statement about the deity of Jesus Christ. Because he said there's only one God. And he says there's only one Lord. And the one God created everything. And the one Lord is the one through whom everything was created. And indicating these two distinct persons. And yet they're both equal in who they are in their very being. And it's just gives evidence to the Trinity. And he's emphasizing that God created all things through Christ. Now that's an interesting point that he makes. Because if God created everything, can meat be evil? It can. It's a creation. It's something God created. In fact, nothing physical is evil in and of itself. Okay, that's an important concept to grasp, and a lot of people struggle with that. You know, take something like heroin. Heroin is a horrible drug, but it's not evil. The heroin itself is not evil. What is evil is what people do with it. It's their relationship that people have with it and how they deal with it. But heroin itself is not a sin. It's not, because nothing physical, sin is not something physical that you can say, oh, this thing here is sin, or this piece of wood is sin. No, this is something that God created. Everything God created is good. It's what people do with it that determines, that makes it evil, and how they respond to it. So the problem is not with the meat. The problem is how people respond. It's what is being done regarding the meat and the circumstances surrounding that. So it is important to know the truth, and knowledge helps us understand the world and make decisions about what's right or wrong. And that's why we have something like Summerside Next, to help people understand theology, because there are a lot of people that make bad choices because they don't understand the truth. So truth is important. Knowledge is important, but it isn't sufficient. And it takes more. And if knowledge isn't important, but it alone doesn't determine right and wrong, love needs to also influence the choices we make. And throughout the rest of this chapter, Paul makes it clear that we need to make choices based on knowledge of the truth and love for others. That's the key to this whole point. We make choices when we're not sure about right and wrong, where God has not been explicitly clear on whether something is right or wrong, whether some activity is right or wrong, whether some place whether we should go there or not. When he is not clear, then we make choices based on what we know and how it affects others in terms of love. And that's what he's going to deal with in the rest of this chapter. Now, what he's talking about here is the whole issue of conscience. Now, what do we mean by a person's conscience? When you think about conscience is that inner sense of right and wrong. And everybody has a conscience. Okay, everybody. Everybody in this world has a conscience. The issue is whether that conscience is active or not, because you can kill your conscience. You can ignore it. You can sort of stifle it. You can put it aside. We have that sense of right and wrong. And Paul is talking about this conscience, and it usually shows up in a feeling. You know, we have a guilty conscience because we feel like we've done something wrong, or we have a clear conscience because we don't feel like we've done something wrong. But in these verses, Paul talks about somebody with a weak conscience. So in verses 7 and 8, he actually says to be aware of the weak conscience. Notice what he says in verse 7. But not everyone possesses this knowledge. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat sacrificial food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to a god. And since their conscience is weak, it is defiled. But food does not bring us near to God. We are no worse if we do not eat it, and no better if we do. So what is a conscience that is weak? Well, here, what Paul is saying is that a conscience that is weak, I guess to answer that question, we should think about, how do you develop your conscience? How does somebody learn to decide whether something is right or wrong? And I think the key is you learn it, right? Now, there is that sense of innate, like a child has a sense of conscience, and everybody has that sense of right and wrong. But we learn as we grow up what's right and what's wrong. And that is that's a true thing, and it's really sad, because you look at our government with the whole sex ed curriculum. The government is trying to train children and shape their conscience. That is why it's such a terrible thing what the government is doing. They are actually shaping the conscience of the child so that when they get older, their concept of right and wrong, good and evil, is twisted according to what the government's trying to do. And that's why we need to deal with it. It's sad, frustrating and sad. And that's why you as parents need to be teaching your children what's right and wrong. And if your children are in school, you need to either pull them out of that class if you can. If they're staying, you need to find out, what are they saying? Now let's talk about that. Let's understand what God says about right and wrong. Because your conscience is something you can train. And it is important to train your conscience. It is important to shape your conscience with the truth. And we all need to educate our consciences. We all need to learn what's right and what's wrong. I was raised with the belief that Christians don't go to movies. Okay, so when I was growing up, it was like, if I went to a movie, I would be sinning. Right? That was what I believed. I was a pastor before I actually ever went to a movie. That's how sheltered I lived. My first movie, do you want to know what it was? I almost felt guilty going to it. Billy Graham, The Prodigal. 1983 or 84 is like, because I was taught in my mind, I thought, if I walk into the theater, that's a place, that's a sinful place. There's a lot of sinful things that are shown in there. So if I go there, I'm going to sin. And I had to change, I had to educate my conscience to understand that that was not true. That there's nothing sinful about that building. And there's just as much sinful stuff on TV that I had in my house as there were showing in that room, right? So it's not like going to that room. And Billy Graham, I mean, it was, you know, I think it was rated PG because it was about this prodigal son, right, who comes back. And so they talked about some of the stuff he did. So, but it was like I had to educate my conscience so that I was responding, so knowledge was shaping what I was thinking, and it was changing the way I was understanding about right and wrong and how I was going to respond to that. Now, a person with a weak conscience is someone who thinks something is wrong because they have come to believe that or they feel that, and maybe they don't understand, they haven't been educated by knowledge yet, but it's something they feel is wrong, and very often, and maybe they have a rule in their mind, like I did, you cannot go to this thing. If you do this, you will sin, even though the Bible doesn't say anything about movies, at least I haven't found it yet. The Bible doesn't say anything about theaters, you know, going to a theater. And so there's this sense in which we need to educate our thinking and understanding, and a person with a weak conscience will believe that they will sin if they break one of their rules, even though that rule is not in the Bible. But it's a part of their conscience. And the Bible tells us to not violate our conscience. Now, it's an important thing because I think I've got time for this illustration. I wasn't going to use it, but let me. It's a great illustration I heard from one of my professors in seminary talking about sin. And he used this illustration when he was a young boy. He was hunting. And duck hunting season was going to close. And I can't remember the exact details. It was, you know, duck hunting season closed like at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on that day. And so he was out with his buddy and they were hunting. And as they were in this boat and they thought, you know, what time is it? They didn't have a watch, no cell phones. This was years ago. And they thought, you know, it's got to be close to 5 o'clock. I'm sure the season is over. And right then, out of the bushes, you can imagine what happened. This flock of ducks comes flying over and they grab their guns and start shooting and kill a couple of ducks. And he said, man, I felt guilty. I knew in my mind duck season had ended and I broke the law. So they went to the officer and went to the conservation office. And as they walk in, they find out it's 4 o'clock. Did they sin by breaking the law? Yes, they did. Because in their mind, they were going against what they knew was what they believed was wrong, and they were making a choice to violate the law, even though in their, even though it was wrong, and, you know, even though what they did was not technically breaking the law, in their, they were making a choice to do something they believed was wrong. So that's the idea behind conscience here. We have our conscience needs to be educated, and we need to be aware of the weak conscience. So we have a brother or sister in Christ that may have a weak conscience, and we need to be aware of that. And the next thing Paul says is we need to respect that. Verses 9 through 13. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your rights does not become a stumbling block to the weak. For if someone with a weak conscience sees you with all your knowledge eating in an idol's temple, won't that person be emboldened to eat what is sacrificed to idols? So this weak brother or sister for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. When you sin against them in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother or sister to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again so that I will not cause them to fall. So Paul says, if you may think it's not a problem to eat at this place because the idols aren't real, this meat is made by God, it's not unholy hamburger, you're going to eat in the idol's temple because you understand what it means. But if a young Christian with a weak conscience thinks that for him to do that, that would be sin, and you are encouraging him to do that, you could be causing him to fall. And the wording Paul uses here is really strong. To destroy. This person is destroyed. Now, he doesn't explain what that means. Now, we know that he can't lose his salvation because Paul makes that clear in other places. But Paul indicates that this person should be growing in their faith, and you're doing something that is preventing that from happening. You're destroying their faith instead of building it up. Now, we're going to be coming back to this topic in a couple of weeks when we get to chapter 10, where Paul expands on this. I'd encourage you to read ahead, not now, but later, and check up a little bit more about that. But let me conclude by making two more points about what Paul is not saying, because some people will be tempted to jump to some conclusions here that I don't think are legitimate from this text. The first thing that Paul is not saying is that we need to make new rules to make sure that no one's conscience is hurt, that no weak conscience is hurt. Because that would be a temptation, right? Okay, we want to make sure nobody with a weak conscience is hurt. So let's think about all the things that could hinder a new Christian. Let's start making rules. Like, don't go to movies. You know, don't dance. Now, if that was Paul's intent, he would say here, we would be reading here, now, about meat offered to idols, don't do it. It's too dangerous. But he doesn't do that. He spends three chapters almost, just talking about this issue, helping you think through knowledge and love and how you need to act according to the truth, and you have to be educated according to the truth, and yet you also have to be sensitive to weak consciences and your brother or sister in Christ. And as soon as we start thinking that we need to make up rules for everything to protect people, we become just like the Pharisees, who had rules for everything to keep people from breaking any of their rules. And that is not how God wants you to live, because Christ preached that we need to live by grace and freedom. And if you're living your life worried about breaking somebody's rule or some rule that you've made up that God never even talks about, you're no longer living in freedom. You're no longer living by grace. You're living by God's, by law, not God's law. You're living by your own law that you've made up. And the way to avoid hurting the weak conscience of a brother or sister is not to create a bunch of rules to somehow protect them, but it's to live a life of love. Because if we live a life of love, and if we live with the desire to care for others and love others and seek to do what's best for others, 99 times out of 100, we'll do the right thing, because our focus will be on caring for one another. And if we do something that offends a brother, we'll go to that person and deal with that with them. So the point is to live a life of love. Now, the second thing that Paul is not saying is he's not saying never offend anyone. There are some people that think, well, you know, maybe somebody comes up to you. Maybe you have somebody in your family that says, well, you know, I don't think you should do this because I don't think Christians should do that. And I'm offended that you do that. He's not talking about those kind of people. He's not talking about Pharisees. Jesus was constantly offending. In fact, you read the Gospels, it's like most of what Jesus did was offending somebody, right? It's like he would do a miracle, somebody was offended. He would do something nice for somebody on Sabbath, somebody's offended. The Pharisees are offended. And Jesus sometimes deliberately offended people that were Pharisees to make a point, to teach them a lesson. So it's not about not offending anybody. It's causing a brother or sister to sin. Okay, that's an important distinction. There's a difference between offending a Pharisee and causing a brother or sister to commit a sin. So keep that distinction in your mind. My father was a godly man, and he was the one that told me never go to movies. He's changed his mind since. But I remember very clearly there was a camp that we were a part of, and there was another mission agency that worked in this camp too, and they had a rule that you couldn't wear shorts in the dining hall. My dad was the speaker that week, and he wore shorts in the dining hall because he thought that was just ridiculous. It was like stinking hot out, and it was like, why are you making these kids wear long pants when it's 35 degrees and there's no air conditioning in this room? It's like, and he said, this is just, we're not going to do this. But they had this thinking somehow that you need to be, you know, dressed properly, and when it wasn't. I've got several other stories if you want to hear about that. But so here's the point. The issue is not to stop doing something because you're afraid of this legalistic brother or sister, what they might think. It really doesn't matter what they think because your responsibility is God. You're not causing them to sin. You may be teaching them a lesson that maybe their standard, the rule they have, is not an appropriate rule. Our love needs to be for the brother or sister who may have a weak conscience, and we need to make sure that we do not do anything that would make them to sin. So we're back at the Hindu feast. Your stomach is grumbling. Your mouth is watering just thinking about that Brahma burger. The server shows up and he says, we've got a special on today, free samosas with every order. You think, oh man, it sounds great. And you wanted to be talking to your friend Sam to find out a little bit more of what he was thinking. But she says, are you ready to order? What are you going to do? That's the first question that you're asked to discuss in your community group this week. So I would encourage you to think about that. And think about other situations that you may face where you're caught in this tension between knowledge and love. But we want to end this morning by celebrating the reason why we need to make these choices based on knowledge and love. Because Jesus Christ is the one who reveals knowledge to us. Jesus Christ is the one who revealed the Father to us. He said, you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He displayed the character of the Father. He taught what the Father was like. We learn about him. We know truth through Christ. And he's also the one who not only taught us what it meant to love, but gives us the ability to love because he's changed our hearts.